Today, is truth the victim? The DFA Daily to the 27th of July 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, where there is post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at the latest disappointing new home sales from the US, recent Bitcoin and Tether moves, the declines in Chinese US stocks, Labour's announcement to keep negative gearing, and the latest from the New Zealand Reserve Bank on the impact of low interest rates in a frankly Mickey Mouse piece of analysis. And just before we start, a quick reminder that at 8 p.m. Sydney time tonight, I'll be joined on my live show by Damien Klassen, the head of investments at Nucleus Wealth and also the What the World Funds. And we'll be discussing the latest developments with regard to the financial markets and the outlook ahead. You can ask a question live using the YouTube chat. So mark your diaries and we'll see you this evening. First, sales of new homes in the US fell to June to the lowest level since the first months of the US coronavirus pandemic in early 2020, as high prices and a limited selection frustrated scores of would-be buyers. Purchases of new single-family homes fell 6.6% to an annual rate of just 676,000, following a downwardly revised 724,000 in May, down, by the way, from the initial 800,000 estimate, according to the US Commerce Department. That's how many homes will be sold in a year if the same number were bought in each month as they were sold in June. The declines in sales were much larger than Wall Street had expected. Economists polled by the Wall Street Journal forecast an annual sales rate of around 795,000. In fact, sales fell in three of four of the US regions. Purchases slumped about 28% in the Northeast, dropped 7.8% in the South, and fell 5.1% in the West. New home purchases account for about 10% of the market and are calculated when contracts are signed. They are considered a timelier barometer than the purchase of previously owned homes, which are calculated when contracts close. The new home sales data, though, is volatile, and the report shows a 90% confidence that the change in sales range from a 23.1% decline to a 9.9% increase. So be a bit careful. Economist Catherine Judge at CIBC World Markets said the jump in home prices had worked to sideline potential home buyers. This print is another piece of evidence confirming that residential investment will likely have become a drag on growth in the second quarter, following a strong performance in the previous few quarters. New home sales had leaped in January to the highest level in almost 15 years, an almost 1 million annualized rate, as buyers took advantage of record low mortgage rates. Yet sales have fallen since then because of high costs and a shortage of new properties for sale. Plenty of people want to buy homes, but high prices and a limited selection are the biggest obstacles. The average cost of a new home is about 12% higher compared with a year earlier, a near record peak. High home prices are the result of strong customer demand and more expensive building materials such as lumber. Builders also can't find enough carpenters, bricklayers, and other skilled craftspeople to do the work. In some cases, builders are even waiting to list homes because they don't want to get stuck eating the higher costs of materials. By waiting, they can pass the costs on to customers later. These problems are expected to act as a drag on the housing market for months to come. Not only that, but also it's preventing many homeowners from selling their current homes because they might not have another home to move into. The median sale price for a new home in the US dropped to $361,000 in June from an all-time high of $380,700 in May, but they're still 6.1% higher than they were a year ago. The number of homes sold in June and awaiting the start of construction, the measure of backlogs, eased from a month earlier to 229,000. The total number of homes sold with construction underway slipped to 289,000 in June. And there were 353,000 new homes for sale in June, the most since the end of 2008. At the same time, only 10% of those houses were already completed. More than 100,000 have not even been started. At the current sales pace, it would take 6.3 months to exhaust the supply of new homes, compared with 5.5 months in the prior month. Elsewhere, Bitcoin fell below $38,000 after briefly visiting $40,000 following Amazon.com's denial that its job posting for a digital currency executive meant that it will accept the token for payments this year. Earlier on Monday, the job posting from the retail giant seeking an executive to develop the company's digital currency and blockchain strategy had stirred questions among analysts over whether the move could eventually lead to Amazon accepting Bitcoin as a method of payment. Shortly before 4 p.m. in New York, an Amazon spokesperson's denial that the company will accept the token for payments this year caused its price to plunge to $37,598, and by 4:42, it was trading at $37,964. Investors rushed to cover bearish bets, which had fueled the earlier rally that drove the coin at one point to more than 17% higher on Monday to $40,545, its highest since June the 15th. More than $950 million of crypto shorts were liquidated on Monday, the most since May the 19th, according to data from Bybit.com. The extent of the jump was probably driven by over-leveraged shorts, said Vijay Avar, head of Asia Pacific at crypto exchange Luno in Singapore. The surge on Monday had brought crypto markets back to life after they'd been stuck in the doldrums for months. On Binance, the largest crypto exchange, Bitcoin perpetual contracts jumped as much as 30% over an hour in early New York trading, a sign of extreme volatility in one of the coin's most liquid derivatives. There's been less volatility in Bitcoin since mid-May, and the enthusiasm for crypto has dissipated somewhat amid a regular crackdown in China and criticism of its toll on the environment. The Amazon job posting was first reported by CoinDesk last week. It's exciting to see Bitcoin rally 10% overnight, said Lucas Luegis, executive director at digital assets hedge fund ARK 36. However, investors should proceed with caution and avoid overtrading, noting that the liquidity is still relatively low as we're heading into the holiday season. To which I would add, yes, this is another example of a little bit of noise creating massive momentum and just shows you how unstable the whole edifice is. Separately, a US probe into Tether is homing in on whether executives behind the digital token committed bank fraud, a potential criminal case that would have broad implications for the crypto market. Tether's pivotal role in the crypto ecosystem is now well known because the token is widely used to trade Bitcoin. But the Justice Department investigation is focused on conduct that occurred years ago when Tether was in its more nascent stages. Specifically, federal prosecutors are scrutinizing whether Tether concealed from banks that transactions were linked to crypto, said three people with direct knowledge of the matter, who were asked not to be disclosed. Criminal charges would mark one of the most significant developments in the US government's crackdown on virtual currencies. That's because Tether is by far the most popular stablecoin, tokens designed to be immune to wild price swings, making them ideal for buying and selling more volatile coins. The token's importance to the market is clear. Tethers in circulation are worth about $62 billion, and they underpin more than half of all Bitcoin trades. Tether routinely has open dialogue with law enforcement agencies, including the DOJ, as part of our commitment to cooperation and transparency, the company said in a statement. Its corporate federal prosecutors have been circling Tether since at least 2018. In recent months, they sent letters to individuals alerting them that they're targets of the investigation. The notices signal that a decision on whether to bring a case could be made soon, with senior Justice Department officials ultimately determining whether charges were warranted. The probe is reaching a tipping point. The stable coins attract intense scrutiny from the regulators. The US Treasury Department and Federal Reserve are among agencies concerned that the tokens could threaten financial stability and are obscuring transactions tied to money laundering and other misconduct because they allow criminals to make payments without going through the regulated payment system. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said last week that watchdogs must act quickly in considering new rules for stablecoins. A hallmark of Tether is that its creators have said each token is backed by one US dollar, either through actual money or holdings that include commercial paper, corporate bonds and precious metals. That has triggered concerns that if lots of traders sold stable coins all at once, that could then lead to a run on assets backstopping the tokens. Fitch Ratings has warned that such a scenario could destabilize short-term credit markets. Tether was first issued in 2014 as a solution to a problem plaguing the crypto market. Banks didn't want to open accounts for virtual currency exchanges because they feared touching funds tied to drug trafficking, cyber attacks, and terrorism. By accepting Tether, exchanges could give traders a way to park their balances without being exposed to Bitcoin's price gyrations. And funds could be transferred instantaneously from exchange to exchange. But Tether's corporate side still needed banks to hold its money and process customer transactions. One early relationship that soured was with Wells Fargo. In 2017, the Tether Limited affiliate and Bitfinex, a crypto exchange with common owners and executives, sued Wells Fargo for blocking wire transfers that had been sought through Taiwanese banks. In the lawsuit, Tether and Bitfinex said Wells Fargo knew or should have known that the transactions were being used to obtain US dollars so clients could purchase digital tokens. The companies dropped the case shortly after filing it. In the course of its year-long investigation, the Justice Department has examined whether traders used Tether tokens to illegally drive up Bitcoin during an epic rally for cryptocurrencies in 2017. While it's unclear whether Tether the company was a target of that earlier review, the current focus on bank fraud suggests prosecutors may have moved on from pursuing a case tied to market manipulation. Tether has already drawn the ire of regulators because in February, Bitfinex and several Tether affiliates agreed to pay $18.5 million to settle claims from New York Attorney General Letitia James that the firms hid losses and lied that each token was supported by one US dollar. The companies had no access to banking in 2017, making it impossible that they had reserves backing the tokens, James said. The firm settled without admitting or denying the allegations. And again, elsewhere, Beijing's sweeping crackdowns of its technology and education sectors has unleashed shockwaves across global markets, erasing $769 billion in value from US-listed Chinese stocks over the course of just 5 months. The Nasdaq Golden Dragon China Index, which tracks 98 of China's biggest firms listed in the US, plunged 7% on Monday after regulators in China unveiled an overhaul of its education sector, which bans firms that teach school subjects from making profits, raising capital, going public. That adds to Friday's 8.5% drop, bringing the gauge's two-day decline to 15%, its biggest since 2008. The latest events arguably highlight that the authorities are more willing to upset investors in pursuit of their broader political goals now than they were a few years ago, wrote Oliver Jones, senior markets economist at Capital Economics, in the note to clients. It's difficult to say precisely what will happen next on this front, but on balance it seems that the downside risks to equities have increased, he said. Some large investors have already started to unload their shares. Cathie Wood's flagship ARK Innovation ETF cut its holdings of China stocks to less than 0.5% this month from a high of 8% in February. The fund completely exited its position in tech giant Baidu and has just 134 shares in Tencent Holdings. Its only other position, the Chinese property site KE Holdings, has dropped 60% so far this year. TAL Education Group, New Oriental Education and Technology Group, and Gaoxiu Tech 2, some of China's largest education companies, all fell at least 26% each on Monday, adding to their record declines from Friday. The trio has seen their shares stuck in an extended plunge since the middle of February, bringing their average losses for the year to 93%. And they're not alone either. In total, more than $106 billion in market capitalization has been raised from Chinese education stocks traded in the US, China, and Hong Kong this year. China's new policy makes these stocks virtually uninvestable, according to JP Morgan analyst DS Kim. The worst case became a reality, he added. While the pain has been felt the most by education and tech stocks, other sectors were also under pressure. So this is definitely an area to watch and a potential wedge into a potentially falling market. Back in Australia, the federal opposition has pledged that it will maintain the government's existing regimes for negative gearing and capital gains tax ahead of the next election. Negative gearing is when an investor borrows against an asset, typically property, in such a manner that it costs the owner more than it makes. It's used as a tax-saving measure, as the 50% capital gains tax deduction that comes with a negatively geared asset can turn it into a profit, and as a way of generating investment in housing. Labour had previously planned to halve the tax deduction in an attempt to raise revenue, saying that it had not had the intended effect on new housing stock and only benefited rich investors. The Labour Party, though, has now confirmed that if voted in, it will uphold legislated changes to personal income tax and it would retain the existing laws for negative gearing and capital gains tax instead of moving ahead with its previous policy. Labour went to the 2016 and 2019 federal elections with proposals to limit negative gearing, the ability to offset net rental investment property losses against wage income, to new housing only. And it also had campaigned to halve the capital gains tax concession. Reflecting on the policy reversal, a joint statement from opposition leader Anthony Albanese and Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers stated that the party was focused on providing clarity and certainty to Australians after a difficult 2 years. Our focus is on making sure Australia emerges from this crisis stronger and more resilient, with an economy that works for working families, not the other way around, Albanese and Chalmers said. Denise Wan, Chief Executive of Master Builder Australia, commented that Mr. Albanese's comments is good news for the building industry, the economy and the community. This announcement shows the opposition's recognition that new home building and increased home ownership is vital to economic recovery and people's financial security, Ms. Wan said. With a federal election looming, the opposition's acknowledgement that restricting negative gearing and increasing capital gains tax would undermine housing supply, jobs and sabotage economic recovery is timely. And Graham Wolfe, Managing Director of the Housing Industry Association, echoed Ms. Wan's statements, asserting that the Labour Party's changes will provide certainty to the housing industry and for Australians that are looking to invest or rent. Private rental housing plays a critical role in Australia's housing supply continuum. Without a reliable pool of residential investors across Australia, hundreds and thousands of households would find it harder to put a roof over their heads, Mr. Wolfe said. Australians need to have the ability to access affordable housing, whether as a renter or as an owner-occupier. HIA looks forward to working with all political parties in the lead-up to the next federal election to develop national policies that will promote housing supply, support home ownership, and ensure that most in need of housing assistance are supported by the government. Further, the Labour Party has also promised to maintain the Stage 3 tax cuts legislated to commence from the 1st of July 2024, which will abolish the 37% tax rate and apply a standard 30% rate to all income between $45,000 and $200,000. The cut will cost the government $137 billion between 2024 and 2030. Prime Minister Scott Morrison had previously blasted the AAP's negative gearing and capital tax proposal, saying it would force a concrete landing for Australia's residential housing market. The property industry also criticised the viability of the negative gearing scrap, with Douglas Driscoll, CEO of Realty Star Partners, saying it would disadvantage investors who are low-income earners. And former Property Investment Professionals of Australia chair Ben Kingsley called the Labour Party's modelling dangerously misleading in 2016, saying the reform would need a more comprehensive and detailed strategy. Or could it be that this just demonstrates that both sides of politics are absolutely captured by the housing and construction sector? I think that's probably nearer the truth. Finally, an analytic note from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. The household cash flow effects of low interest rates in New Zealand tells us the blindingly obvious. Those with mortgages have benefited in cash flow terms as rates were cut, thanks to monetary policy, while those relying on interest from savings from bank deposits have been taken to the cleaners. They took the population as it was in 2016, and consider what the distributional impacts would have been if mortgage and bank deposit rates immediately declined to their current 2020 levels. The reduction in term deposit and mortgage rates between 2000 and 2020, all other things constant, and that's important, implies a net positive income gain of 0.1% across all New Zealand households. Whoopee. On average, mortgage holders experienced a 1% increase in income, while non-mortgage holders saw a 0.4% reduction in income. Across the population, the reduction in income due to a lower term deposit rate exceeded any increase in income from lower mortgage rates for the bottom three income deciles. Almost half of those households are in the 65 plus age group. The decline in interest rates also had varying effects across age groups. Those in their prime earning years of 25 to 54 gained on average 0.3%, while the gross income of older workers of 55 to 64 and retirees at 65 plus declined by 0.1 and, wait for it, 0.5% respectively. Except it appears they missed the obvious point that the average new mortgage has grown substantially. In Australia, for example, a new first-time buyer typically has a loan 50% bigger than a year ago, which annihilates any potential cash savings, and depositors are eating into their capital to survive as term rates fall. So they have a smaller stash of savings, which means in real terms their true position is worse, so much worse than the modelling suggests. I have to say, I get very tired of these simplistic models so often used by central bankers to justify their monetary policy. It's a pity that it's so disconnected from reality. I'm just saying. And once again, it's the majority of people with savings who are being taken to the cleaners, whilst, of course, home ownership rates continue to decline both in Australia and in New Zealand, and housing affordability is also going backwards. This is a policy disaster area in both countries, and frankly, I don't see it changing because, of course, the banks, the government, and construction industry all align. It's just that they align on the side against real Australians and New Zealanders, and that's a problem. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.